All right, this is case 79 from the Book of Serenity. Changsha advancing a step. The introduction. The Bodhisattva appearing as a maiden on the banks of golden sand was a special spirit. Stuffing pastries in a crystal jar, who would dare to roll it? Without going into the frightening waves, it's hard to find a suitable fish. How about when one expression of walking relaxed with a big stride? The case. Changsha had a monk ask Master Hui, how was it before you saw Nan Quan? Hui remained silent. The monk said, how about after seeing him? Hui said, there could be nothing else. The monk returned and related this to Changsha, and Changsha said, the man sitting atop a 100-foot pole, though he's gained entry, this is not yet the real. Atop a 100-foot pole, he should step forward. The universe in all directions is the whole body. The monk said, atop a 100-foot pole, how can you step forward? Changsha said, the mountains of Lang, the rivers of Li. The monk said, I don't understand. Changsha said, the whole land is under the imperial sway. Changsha Jingsen was his full name. He was a 9th century teacher. A successor of Nan Quan, or as you may know, Nan Sen, and the grandson of Matsu, the great Dharma brother of the great Chao Chu, Joshu. He was known for his pointed and pierced style of teaching. The nickname was the Tiger. Jing Sen means tiger. This name came about when Changsha one time was hanging out with Yangshan. They were enjoying the moon. Yangshan said, everybody is completely endowed with this, but they are unable to make use of it. And Changsha said, I invite you to use it. Yangshan asked, how would you use it? Changsha knocked Yangshan down with a shove to his chest, then stepped on him. Yangshan said, just like a tiger. From this day forward, Changsha was known as the Tiger. In Zen, as some of you know, the moon is a depiction of realization. In this dialogue, they were sitting together enjoying the moon. Maybe they were enjoying the moon. Or possibly they were just enjoying pure being. Right? And everybody's got it. It's a good statement. It's a very true statement. But what do you do with it? Now, to know that you are endowed with it, to know that you are a Buddha, doesn't mean anything, doesn't do anything. Until it becomes every breath, every action, every gesture. Not judged, not waiting for something else. We have an idea of what the moon is, how it looks like. It's round, it's bright, it's clear. Right? There's a lot of stuff that I have to get out of the way before I can see that moon. And working very hard to remove, to chip away, to uncover, to discover. Keizan Zenji said about this moon realization. He said, though clear waters range to the vast blue autumn sky, how can they compare with the hazy moon on a spring night? Most people want to have pure clarity, but sweep as you will, you cannot empty the mind. The hazy moon is that exact moon. Right? Not after, not later, not after everything is clear, not after I've figured out a way to stop this madness, stop thinking, solve all the problems. Solve all the problems, you know, one of the conversations in Dokusan today kind of hovered around this, solving all the problems. We do have this notion, or at least we want to solve everything, and we think we can. And I think it's important for us to recognize that we will never be able to solve everything. You can live an entire lifetime of devoting yourself to others' well-being, and still you will not solve everything. And even when you think you are solving something, sometimes you're doing more harm than good. But what you can do, is remove the doubt. You can see, it is possible to see the hazy moon as realization. Hazy, murky, sometimes doesn't smell so good. So we sit there and we talk about it. It's another thing too. We talk about how beautiful it is, how, you know, nice spring night. But what do we do with it? It's a good question. What do we do with it? And he said, well, you know, I invite you to use it. Of course, he's not asking his Dharma brother to use it. He's asking you to use it. He's inviting you today to use that wisdom, use the realization. So instead of looking for that moon, instead of looking for peace, how about looking at where and why and how we create resistance, we create war, we create stagnation. And that's what this koan is about. Being stuck somewhere, we're stuck. To understand a little bit more about Changsha, Zen Master Changsha entered the hall one time and addressed the monks, saying, if I give you some religious teaching, then there will be grass growing in the hall 10 feet deep. But this is something that can't be stopped. Right? It's going to happen. So I say to you that all the worlds pervading the 10 directions are the true monk's eye. All worlds pervading the 10 directions are completely the monk's body. Pervading all worlds in the 10 directions is your own brilliant light. And all worlds in the 10 directions are within your own light and within your reach. And throughout all worlds in the 10 directions, there is not a being that is not you. This is what I've taught you when I've said that all the Buddhas, Dhammas, and sentient beings of the three worlds are the great light of wisdom. But even before this light was propagated, what is the place where you existed? Where did you come from? Where did you come from today? Do you know? From where did the mountains, rivers, and the great earth came from? Years ago, the Buddha recognized the human condition as stuck axle wheel, as we are stuck, right? It's an ancient recognition of this day. And it's very important that we recognize and admit that in one way or another we are stuck. We're holding on to something. Even when you feel good, you have some good days, things are flowing. If you look deep enough, you will see you are sitting on your own version of a 100-foot pole. And we have to look. Because when things are flowing, it doesn't mean that it's not hiding somewhere. Because if you don't look and things are flowing and the week after they're not flowing, you're very surprised. I thought I'm done with that. Or I thought I went to 35 sessions with someone who gave me a certificate telling me that I've cleared this one. So how come it's happening again? How come it's happening? You know, we chant in the Heart Sutra, Avalokiteshvara, clearly so emptiness of all senses, right? Through all the senses through which we interact on a momentary basis. To see clearly, to see where you're stuck, is essential. Because if you don't see where you're stuck, you don't even know what to work on. Right, to admit, I am stuck. So Avalokiteshvara, so clearly. Do you see clearly? Remember that everything we chant is not about repetition or reciting or holding on to some kind of a tradition that we have to pass on to the next generation. You don't want to pass on a tradition. You want to pass on realization. You want to wake up. And that you pass on. The ability. You pass on to others. The strength. Right? You do it. And then you tell others, yes, you can do it. It's difficult, it's painful, but you can do it. Because everything changes. Because even when we feel that we are stuck, it is possible to get unstuck. It is doable. How do we do it? One word. Attention. That pretty much sums it up. Attention. Right? All the Qurans, or most of the Qurans, begin with that word. To truly pay attention, right? To truly turn the lights on. But attention to what? Right? Yeah, I can pay attention. You know, it's easy to pay attention when things are moving nicely, or I'm interested in what I'm paying attention to. But how do we practice attention? And maybe how do we know when we are not paying attention? Start with the things that you are not interested in. Start with the ones that you're interested in the least. Like when you take your shoes off, put them on the shoe rack downstairs. I don't know why it happens so often, but I come in, sometimes people are here, and I see shoes off the shoe rack on the carpet. Next to the shoe rack. Not that far. Right? And that's a blinking light. Or it should be a blinking light for us. I'm not paying attention. I'm not paying attention. That's one way to look at it. The other thing is that sometimes we do it because, well, you know, this, I'm not going to practice putting my shoes on the rack. That's nothing. You know, I'm going to practice the real stuff. Right? That's not the meat and potatoes. This is just something to get through before I get to the important stuff, which is upstairs, second story. Right? But if you don't pay attention to putting your shoes on the shoe rack, you're not going to pay attention later on. Or maybe partial attention. Of course, you know, we grow up in a society, in a culture that says that tying your shoes is not as valuable as winning the lottery. Right? Of course. I'm tying my shoes. There's nothing there. What does that get me? Well, it gets you to the next moment. Right? That's important. Are you alive to tying the shoes? You know, it's just so many things we take for granted, but you know, moving your five fingers in such unison to tie your shoes or to untie your shoes is a miracle. It is truly a miracle. But we do it every day, so I can do it, you know, I can do my eyes closed. So since I can do it with my eyes closed, it does not require my attention. So I can, while I do that, pay attention to the story, which is far more interesting than tying the shoes. But examine your life. Look at your life moment by moment. How often do you forget things? Where did I place this? What did I do with that? How often do we repetitive things in such an inefficient way, over and over and over again? Why? Because we're not there. Because we're not paying attention. Because we're all stuck. There is no such thing as more important or less important. There is no such thing, period. Because life does not come this way. Life comes as it comes. Life is not more life when you become interested in things, or less life when you find it not interesting. It doesn't have that capability. It shows up day by day, moment by moment. It just shows up. What do you want to be when it shows up? And starting to measure it and starting to quantify puts us in a very difficult place, because we mess with it. We argue. Constantly argue with it. I don't like it. I like it. It's working. It's not working. It's not the right color. It doesn't match. I was talking to my daughter yesterday. I asked her, you know, why do you wear sneakers in such weather? You're stepping in snow. You got cloth sneakers. She said, well, you know, my boots don't go with these pants. Which, you know, it made perfect sense for her, right? Forget life, you know, I mean, look at the, come on, you know, it's not matching, you know, who cares? But we do it. This is a funny thing, but we do it. We do it all the time, you know. We have our own measurements, or our own tools. Forget life itself, you know, it's just, it doesn't work for me. Doesn't work for me. So being stuck. Now, I thought about it. You know, how often you ask people, how are you? And they tell you, I'm fine. Very quickly. So quickly, before you even finish the sentence, I'm fine, I'm good. Right? They're basically saying, don't remind me what I don't want to hear, what I don't want to know. You know, I don't want you to, I don't want to talk about it. I want to pretend everything is good. Right? I want to pretend there's no problem. I'm cruising. Life's moving. No issues. But it's not like that. It's not like that. In one way or another, again, we are stuck. We are sitting on some kind of 100-foot, 40-foot, 1,000-foot pole. And Changsha is urging you, us, to take a step forward. To recognize, realize, you've been here too long. You may like the view, fine. Stay there for a little while. We'll move on. You know, denial is a very commonly practiced commodity. But we do have to see that practicing denial is practicing war. It's the opposite of practicing peace. Because you are resisting, because you're not seeing things as they are. You may see what you want to see, but not what is. So practicing denial will inevitably lead to unwholesome life. It's just how it is. And the opposite, practicing lights on, seeing things as they are, will result in a wholesome life. Maybe that's a wrong statement. Is wholesome life already. Right? Because when you see things as they are, nothing is hiding. Life is as it is, as it needs to be. So getting us stuck is extremely important, right? But before that, we have to realize that we are stuck. Why is it not good to be able to be stuck? Well, what happens to water when it's stagnant? It starts to smell, right? It starts to collect all kinds of stuff. It's still water, but it stinks. And as soon as movement starts to happen, gets washed away. Smells better, cleaner, clearer. But the borderline of the puddle is not as defined anymore, right? It's a big issue for us. Because I know very well the borderline, the defined shape of that particular puddle. Yeah, it smells bad. It's my sock. My puddle. My water. I know how it tastes like. About 10 years ago, I want to bring it up in relation to getting stuck and unstuck. About 10 years ago, a brain neuroscientist, Professor Richard Davidson, traveled to India to conduct an experiment on the brain's plasticity with a bunch of Buddhist monks. Some of you may have heard about that. The term plasticity refers to the brain's ability to change its structure and function, in particular by expanding or strengthening circuits that are used and by shrinking and or weakening those that are rarely engaged. In its short history, the science of neuroplasticity has mostly documented brain changes that reflect physical experiences and input from the outside world. In pianists, for example, who play many arpeggios, for instance, brain regions that control the index finger and middle finger become fused, apparently, because when one finger hits the key in one of these fast tempo movements, the other does so almost simultaneously, fooling the brain into thinking that these two fingers are one. As a result of that, the pianist can no longer, at some point, can no longer move those fingers independently of the other. Is that true? You may know that. You haven't played enough arpeggios. All right. However, scientists have begun to wonder whether the brain can change in response to purely internal mental signals. And that's where the Buddhists come in. Their centuries-old tradition of meditation offers real-life experiment in the power of working with thoughts to alter the physical matter of the brain. In this experiment, they had two groups. The first group consisted of novice monks who have had experience of about 2,000 meditation hours total. And the second group consisted of well-seasoned monks with a minimum of 10,000 meditation hours. 10,000 hours. Minimum. The monks got hooked up to about 256 sensors to monitor different responses of their brain. Their task was to practice compassion meditation, generating a feeling of loving kindness towards all beings. In a striking difference between novices and long-time practitioners, The latter showed a dramatic increase in high-frequency brain activity called gamma waves. During compassion meditation, gamma waves during compassion meditation, thought to be the signature of neural activity that knits together far-flung brain circuits, gamma waves underline higher mental activity such as consciousness. The novice meditators showed a slight increase in gamma activity, but most monks showed extremely large increase of a sort that has never been reported before in the neuroscientist literature. Professor Davidson said that it suggests that the mental training can bring the brain to a greater level of consciousness. So it's not only a stimulant from the outside. It can be generated from within. That's what we do. During a brain scan called functional MRI, the scientists pinpointed regions that were active during compassion meditation. In almost every case, the enhanced activity was greater in the monks' brain than in the monks that practiced longer than the novices. Activity in the prefrontal cortex, the seat of positive emotions such as happiness, swamped activity in the right prefrontal, site of negative emotions and anxiety. Something never before been seen from purely mental activity, as a result of purely mental activity. It's quite amazing, isn't it? A sprawling circuit that switches on at the site of suffering also showed greater activity in the monks. So did region responsible for planned movement, as if the monks' brains were itching to go to the aid of those in distress. It's how we work, when we work the way we need to work. It's how we are. These results open up the tantalizing possibility that the brain, like the rest of the body, can be altered intentionally. Just as aerobics sculpt the muscles, so mental training sculpts the gray matters in ways scientists are only beginning to fathom. This stuff works. Well, I guess in case you need it, or in case you need some scientific proof, it's becoming more apparent. It does work. The good thing about that, about plasticity, is that, or recognition of plasticity, is that as stuck as you think you are, you can change it. It can be changed. You are a lot more malleable than you think. A lot more flexible than you think. But you think. Which actually is exactly why you don't see or you don't experience the plasticity. You don't allow it. If I keep telling myself, I can't do it, I can't do it, I can't do it. Well, what happens? There's no growth. Or even if there is growth, there's no recognition. There may be growth, but that growth has to be empowered by you. So you must be thinking, 10,000 hours of meditation, how long will that take? Right? It's like flying hours. Well, you know about that. It's like accumulating, for a pilot, accumulating flying hours. Right? Everything revolves around that, right? How many flying hours do you have? It doesn't really matter because, you know, if you sit, you sit. And even one period of sitting is already doing what it needs to do. He's already starting to pay attention, starting to allow the possibility of plasticity, of responsiveness, of change to happen. It is doable. You're doing it. But yes, it does matter how long and how often we sit. You can sit for 10 minutes a day, and I'm sure you will recognize, and I'm sure you will benefit from it. You will recognize changes and you will benefit from it. But it won't be to such an extent. So it is important to sit a significant amount of time. This is why we have on a regular basis sesshins and zazenkais. This is why it's essential. It's not just we like to hang out together and, you know, we're trying very hard to find opportunities to spend time together. It's not about that. Which is very nice, but it's not about that. It's about really putting it to work. It's about really doing what we need to do to expose ourselves to this kind of practice. And the brain responds. And your life will respond. Your ability to work with what comes will respond. And you're doing it. But remember the commitment, remember that it does take time. It does take time, and you need to make on a daily basis, you need to make a commitment. Because if you don't make a commitment, it's not going to work. And you will not experience getting unstuck. In this case, what Changsha is pointing at is slightly different than maybe what you feel or where you're stuck or each one of us is stuck. This guy Hui apparently was given succession. I mean, he became successor of Nansen in secret. I don't know why. He doesn't say why. But that's as far as we know. So Nansen did make him a teacher. And that's why he sent the monk to ask him, well, what about after you saw Nansen? What about after you had realization? And he said there could be nothing else. Admitting that he's stuck. If you remember, that's the fourth kind of blindness. A few weeks ago I spoke about the five different kinds of blindness. This is the fourth one. Getting stuck, thinking you realized. It's a very difficult illness to cure because you really think you got it. It's a very high pole to step away from, to step down from. And it's very important for all of us to recognize that even when a teacher becomes or has successorship and becomes a teacher, right, at the moment of becoming a teacher, this does not mean that that person stops practicing or stops expanding or deepening. It means that there is a recognition that this person has realized something, which is very true. And at that level, that person knows very well how to keep moving forward. That's the expectation. So maybe the study itself doesn't have to be so systematic, but it doesn't end. Because everybody is teaching everybody. Because every moment is teaching us. And the deepening never ends. For all of us. Which I think is good, because it means we're all in the same place, essentially. We're all working in the same way. Which makes this even more cozy, right? So let's get unstuck. And let's not fool ourselves that we are not stuck.